court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Federal Land Bank versus Sloan.
May it please the court, as indicated, I represent the Federal Land Bank Association of Tyler. I believe there are really only four facts that are needed to understand this appeal. The first is that the Sloans applied to the bank in Tyler for a loan to build a chicken house that was to be secured by a lien on their real estate, which would make the loan agreement subject to the statute of frauds. The second is that a bank employee orally told them that their loan had been approved. The bank later did not make the loan because it subsequently learned that the Sloans had submitted materially misleading and false financial statements to the bank.
What was the time gap between the second and third fact that you just recited?
I believe it was approximately a month, Your Honor. The Sloans concede that the bank was justified in denying the loan application, but they have sought damages in any event. The two points of error that I will discuss with you this morning are, first, our position that the statute of frauds bars the Sloan's recovery for negligent misrepresentation, and secondly, that one cannot in Texas recover mental anguish on negligent misrepresentations. As I said, this controversy arises out of an agreement by the bank to make a loan. The agreement was oral and was later rescinded. In their pleadings, they say specifically that they had a loan and that we repudiated it. It is important to our position to stress that the policy underpinnings of the statute of frauds are well rooted in this state and have stood for the proposition of giving business certainty to contracts where it is applicable. In efforts to get indirect recovery for an item that really falls within the statute of frauds, has been guarded against by the court. And we believe that the Court of Appeals decision here will cause great business uncertainty. In the Weber case, which is a court out of the Houston court, establishes the proposition that just because a plaintiff alleged and couched his claim in terms of fraud, that did not prevent the court from barring a claim for misrepresentations relating to an oral employment contract when it felt that that oral contract was subject to the statute of frauds. Similarly, other courts have said that a claim of fraud does not set aside the statute of fraud. And there should
Why does a representation as to an existing fact, if it's negligent and false, violate the statute of fraud? In other words, in this case, you say the loan application has been approved when it hasn't. Why is that a violation of the statute of fraud?
Because, Your Honor, the only conduct against the bank that was claimed to be actionable was their failure to honor their oral agreement. The only conduct that's complained up here is, in essence, that the bank did not perform its oral promise. And in, for example, the Kyotis case, that was a tort claim court case, but the actionable conduct was the contract conduct, that there were misrepresentations made about the sale of land. And the court held there in a deceptive trade practice case that although you called it a tort, you were really suing for the breach of the promise or the representation that was made. And there was no attempt to establish any act other than the promise to loan money, that is, your loan has been approved, in this case.
Well, if a bank officer tells someone that a loan has been approved when it hasn't been, and he is negligent in doing that, and that statement is false, and the person goes out and damaged by reliance on it, isn't that a claim for negligent misrepresentation?
It is characterized certainly as a claim here, Your Honor, for that claim. But what we are saying from the Kyotis court, there it was a failure to perform an oral contract, and they did not let them get lost salary or benefits or cost of expenses because the only conduct that was looked at was the promise. In essence, Your Honor, what we're saying is that all the injury here flows from the repudiation. In other words, I don't think there's any question that if a ribbon had been tied around this and then the bank learned this information and it repudiated the contract, that even if the Sloans had gone out and spent money, the bank would have been entitled to repudiate it and they would not have been able to sue. So that because of the nature of the injury...
Why isn't this a restatement section 90 claim? Why couldn't you make a claim?
I suppose it could, Your Honor.
And secondly, on the statement you just made, there was a month delay here. What if it had been 2 or 3 year delay? And your business is up and running and times get hard and the bank finds out that it's...
That might make a difference. Certainly the facts would make a difference. But I think that here... The policy position that we are advocating to you is that in a situation where the ultimate contract or the contract is subject to the statute of frauds, that the Texas courts that we've cited have, when they are sure that the conduct complained of is the breach of the promise, which it is here, have not permitted recovery because of the policy of the statute of frauds that there has to be a writing. And that is the policy that is at issue here. And when you know that all of the damages flow from the repudiation, for example, they say they made us in reliance on the representation, I believe actually they've been damaged for their inability to meet those commitments. And certainly each of the fraud or each of the negligent misrepresentation allegations that they make are based on a promise that we will loan you money that was not fulfilled. They've mentioned the Pilgrim Agreement specifically and said, well, that's a tort injury that doesn't flow from the bank loan. We say that in substance that's not correct, but for the bank loan there would have been no Pilgrim contract. And they are clearly there seeking the benefit of the contract, which would not be permitted under the 4 or 5 cases, the Collins, the Weber, and the Bernoit case that we cite. So again, our policy position is where a claim arises from an oral promise to loan money that's subject to the statute of frauds, there should be no recovery for not fulfilling that promise. And whether that is couched as a breach of contract or negligent misrepresentation should not be decisive. Excuse me.
Just on a factual basis, I want to be sure of the facts here. It's my understanding that the Sloans communicated with Mr. Weeks, who is the bank's loan officer.
That's correct.
He's the one who contacted them and told them that the loan had been approved. Then they went out and contracted with Mr. Sofol to perform the work. Sofol was not willing to begin construction until either there was an executed loan document or he had some confirmation from the bank, so he contacted Mr. Weeks, and Mr. Weeks indeed told him that the loan had been approved as an add-on type of transaction to the Sloan's home mortgage, and only then did he commence the work. Is that correct?
I think for the purposes of the appeal, that is the record. That was disputed at the trial, but that's certainly what the jury found. But that it is still, I think, Your Honor, does not change the position that what they are suing for is that the bank did not keep the promise to loan them the money. And certainly the damages that they seek all flow from not keeping that promise. And under Weber and Collins and Coyote and the Benoit case, they have said that efforts by a plaintiff when the conduct is conduct related and the damages flow from that breach, that in effect you are suing for the failure to perform, and therefore that is subject to the statute of frauds, which has been for banks and other institutions something that's there. And I think changing that policy or not following those cases here could have a real chilling effect on the bank business.
Why would it have a chilling effect on the bank business? I think they would simply be very cautious about making oral commitments.
Well, they certainly would do that, but I think it also shows the hazard and what the statute of frauds is supposed to avoid, that we not have to have these disputes.
It's a standard practice in the banking community to make such oral commitments to get transactions commenced, in this case, so the work could be started. Did Mr. Weeks tell Mr. Sopel, it's all right, go ahead and start it. The loan's been approved. It's going to be an add-on to their home mortgage. Banks do this in the regular course of business. They should be accountable for it, shouldn't they?
I think here, when the statute of frauds applies, that until there is a written contract, the person who changes his position should be at risk. Otherwise, the policy of the
You can't take the bank's word for it, right?
I don't think
that would be a chilling effect, I would think.
When you know, I think that you can, when you sue them for not performing on that promise, which they've done, I mean, they've sought both profits and expenses.
The bank can't be held accountable for that kind of commitment. That wouldn't be a effect on such transactions.
I don't believe so. I do not believe that a bank can be accountable in that situation when it is conceded that the liability-generating conduct is the failure to perform, can be subject to either profits or expenses that flow from that under the cases we've decided, that they are seeking the benefit of the contract that they say was breached.
Why don't the same damages flow from the negligent misrepresentation?
They certainly would, Your Honor, the standard that was used is that you have to look at the substance of whether this is a tort, negligent misrepresentation, that was driving the action, or is it in substance a breach of contract.
In other words, the bank did not have to make the loan. They did not have an enforceable obligation to make the loan because of the statute of frauds. But they said they were going to.
And then they subsequently learned that they got false financial statements, and they said they were not.
Now, if they made a negligent misrepresentation, why aren't they bound by that?
Because
as opposed to the oral promise.
Because the conduct and damages that they sued for here flow from the breach. That is, the profits and the expenses flow from that breach. And the cases have said that you cannot, in that instance, characterize it and call it negligent misrepresentation and recover because the statute of frauds and its policy prevents you from being able, or prevents one from being able to do that. Let me move to negligent misrepresentation. Basically, our point here is that this court has not permitted and should not permit mental anguish to be applied to negligent misrepresentation. Unlike the preceding argument, in this case, damages for negligent misrepresentation flow from the statement of torts that say expressly that damages are recoverable for negligent misrepresentations for those necessary to compensate the plaintiff for the pecuniary loss. It's acknowledged that mental anguish are not pecuniary losses, and therefore it was error to allow them to be recovered here. And I'd like to spend a few moments.
Has that particular restatement been adopted by any Texas?
Yes, sir. We cite cases, the Rosenthal case in Houston, the Trainer case. I think there are about five cases at the Court of Appeals level that have adopted it and have said that it calls for pecuniary losses. Now, in terms of the litany of your prior decisions, I do not believe that they support an award of mental anguish in a negligent misrepresentation case. The Sanchez case was a wrongful death action over the death of a child. It is true in Sanchez that the court said that the Wrongful Death Act was not expressly limited recovery to pecuniary loss, whereas here the restatement does. But more importantly, Sanchez does not address a commercial or economic context, but rather the wrongful death action.
Well, if this had been a misrepresentation that was actionable under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, wouldn't it be possible to recover from mental anguish?
I believe that it would because the statute there talks about, or you could make the argument it would because the statute, like the wrongful death statute, is not limited. I personally, as a policy matter, would not apply it to the commercial context because I believe in just listening to the argument that went before me, part of what I was going to say, that your cases and the debates have, from, say, your dissent, Your Honor, and Reagan, talked about how pro-family are we going to be. We've talked about the family unit. You talked this morning about whether divorce is a family unit or not a family unit, and did that make a difference? My basic point is we don't fall under any of those. And we're in the commercial context with the restatement that has limited it, and I do not believe that there are any decisions by this court that have applied mental anguish in a simple negligence test, and unlike the case before us, the negligent infliction of mental distress was not pled here.
Do I understand your answer to be then that if this had been a misrepresentation that was actionable under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act in a commercial non-family situation, that mental anguish would be an appropriate element?
That would be my position.
Any other questions? Thank you, sir. Court is ready to hear oral argument from respondent.
Please, the court. Mr. Blair, A. Duke will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court. Blair Bisbee of the Seal Stover Law Firm of Jasper for the Sloan family in this appeal. This is not a statute of frauds case, and it's not a case that involves an attempt to enforce an agreement to make a loan. There is some perhaps inappropriate language in the petition about repudiation, but the petition clearly states the cause of action for negligent misrepresentation, and it was properly submitted to the trial court, and in fact there have been no complaints preserved on appeal about the manner in which the case was submitted as a negligent misrepresentation case. It does not involve the bank's failure to make a loan. Rather, it involves a misrepresentation as to whether or not a loan would have been made and a lucrative business opportunity that was lost as a result thereof.
Would have been made, had been made, or what?
There was sufficient evidence in the record in this case to show that these folks would have entered into the transaction, and the lost profits were proved with reasonable certainty, and I do want to address that point a little bit further on in the argument.
What is the negligence misrepresentation in this case?
That a loan application had been approved. Had they been told that they
is
were not...
Is there any evidence that at the time that statement was made it wasn't true?
Well, I don't know whether there is or not. There are documents
in
the...
Well, how could it be actionable if it was true?
That's a good question and one that has not occurred to me to this point. But in the context of what in fact happened in this case, and I do want to discuss a little bit the time element that Justice Phillips inquired about, because I don't believe the response was accurate to the record. The references to the statement of facts are contained in our brief, but what happened is that the application was made in late February or early March. The supposed omissions from the financial statements were discovered in June. The bank never notified the plaintiffs that the loan was denied until August, although they were aware during that entire time that time was the essence of this agreement, and that if the project was not, quote, off the ground by the end of the summer, that the Sloans were going to lose their commitment from Pilgrim's Pride, and that is, in fact, exactly what happened. And
you're not contending that they had an obligation to hurry, and the jury
didn't find that.
You're contending that the negligent misrepresentation.
No, they had an obligation to exercise ordinary care to make certain that any information that they transmitted was correct. When he transmitted false information, that is, that the application has been approved and that the loan is going to be made, that satisfied the requirements of the cause of action by communicating false information and failing to exercise ordinary care in connection with that communication.
What evidence is there that it was false?
The fact that the loan was never made, and in fact the application was denied.
Well, if the complaint is that he represented that the loan would be made, it seems like that is directly within the statute of frauds.
No, I don't believe it is, because, again, the analysis is what damages are the plaintiff seeking as a result of the alleged tortious conduct. And they're not saying we had to go out and get another loan somewhere else and we're paying more interest. They are saying the damage is the loss of the contract with Pilgrim's Pride and the business opportunity, and then the other expenses that we incurred in reasonable reliance upon the false information that was communicated.
Well, so the negligent misrepresentation is that the loan would be made. The loan will be made at some point.
Well, I guess there too, that the application has been approved and that the loan will be made.
So, focusing on the first part, so I'll be very clear about it. Is there any evidence in this record that when the statement was made, this loan has been approved, it was false?
Yes, there is, because there's testimony from the bank president and Mr. Weeks himself that he's not the one to approve the loan, that the committee had not yet met, and that no decision had been made one way or the other on the application of the loan. And if the court requests, I'll be happy to provide citations to the records by way of a supplemental letter brief. But my recollection from trying this case is that there is testimony both by Weeks and Conover, the president of the bank, that that was the case. I don't believe that the Tyler Court's opinion in this case conflicts with the prior Court of Appeals opinions that are relied upon as the jurisdictional basis under subsection 2 in this case, and that would be the Benoit and the Weber cases and these others. The reason being, again, because the Sloan family is not attempting to enforce an agreement for the loan of money in this case, and their damages, again, are not measured by a difference in interest rates between this particular loan and another loan that they might have gotten. Rather, they were deprived of the opportunity of getting a loan at all because of the delay in communicating the information and because of the false information that was communicated. And we look to their losses under the business opportunity. And again, the Court of Appeals analysis is accurate and is correct under the case law. You look both to the nature of the damages sought and the relationship of the promise to the purposes of the statute of frauds. We come back again to the fact that this is a cause of action that sounds in tort and not in contract, and therefore contract defenses and contract analysis are inappropriate. It's also important, I think, for the court to recognize the fact that we're dealing with a common law cause of action here and not any type of creature of statute. The argument is made almost that because the restatement of torts has language in there about pecuniary losses, that this court would somehow be limited by that language, and of course that's not correct. It's also appropriate to note that that language was first drafted in 1938, the initial draft of Restatement Section 552. It was revised in 1966. It's over 50 years old, and it's archaic in terms of recognizing the type of damages that flow from a tort of this type.
Is there a Restatement Third that's in the works?
I do not know the answer to that. I know that it was revised again in the late 70s. I'm not sure what the current status of it is. Again, certainly it is this court's responsibility to recognize the evolution of the common law in this regard, and I think allowing the recovery of mental anguish damages in situations of this type is compelled by this court's prior rulings in cases of this nature,
is there any personal injury. Is there any line you can draw when a breach of contract case becomes a mental anguish case?
Again, we have to look to the nature of the damages that are asserted out of the thing. And I think it's clear when you analyze this case in that manner that they are not seeking to enforce the contract. They are not here requesting specific performance of a promise to make a loan. They're seeking damages for economic loss and mental anguish that was reasonably foreseeable as a result of a tortious action that was committed by the bank's employee.
And that's marital discord, migraine headaches, and financial strain.
Sure. They should be allowed to recover all damages that approximately result from the tort. And again, we're under a foreseeability and cause in fact analysis, and both elements are well satisfied in this case. The bank officer knew what the purpose of the loan was, and he well understood the ramifications of the time frame within which the Sloans were operating. And the fact that they would lose the contract and lose out on the opportunity was certainly reasonably foreseeable from the bank's standpoint.
What's left of the statute of frauds?
Those situations to which it actually applies. If the Sloans had come into court,
except for your theory.
I disagree. They're not in court trying to enforce an agreement, an oral agreement to make a loan. They're in court to recover tort damages for tortious conduct consisting of negligent misrepresentation, communicating false information upon which they reasonably rely.
Can't you make that claim in every contract? contract accepted?
Certainly you can, but under the analysis of determining what the nature of the damages sought are and the relationship of the promise to the purposes of the statute of frauds, we're not talking about a promise in this case. We're talking about a statement of fact. Your application has been approved. Your loan will be made. And they have the right to rely on that, and they should have the right to come to court and seek redress for the wrongs that were visited upon them as a result of that reliance.
This seemed like sort of a tort counterpart to promissory estoppel.
And
in this setting would be very limited because it would, the courts have been loath to see it circumvent the statute of fraud.
Well, that's true, and I think in each individual case, a careful analysis of the facts will be necessary. And indeed, that's what the courts of appeals have done in these other cases that are relied on by the bank, the employment contract cases. And I think the analysis there is appropriate, even as in the land conveyance and contracts to make a will cases. When the damages that the plaintiff is seeking is what the benefit of the bargain they would have had if the promise was enforced, indeed, the claim does sound in contract instead of tort. But that's not our situation here. And I think that the Court of Appeals correctly analyzed that. Now, where I run into problems with the Court of Appeals opinion is denying the recovery of lost profits in the case. And it seemed to me I beg your pardon?
Why aren't lost profits the benefit of the bargain?
Well, because there was no profit to be made off of the loan from the bank. This had to do with a contractual relationship with a third party that was destroyed by the bank's tortious contract. It was, however, foreseeable, and the tortious conduct was a cause in fact of the loss, and therefore it should be recoverable. And I want to say that I do...
What can you get in a contract action, if it weren't for the statute of frauds, that you can't get in a negligent misrepresentation action?
Over and against the bank, suing them in contract if the statute of frauds was not a defense, specific in performance of the loan agreement, I would assume.
But as far as the consequential damages, remedial damages, mental anguish, lost profits, whatever, those are all recoverable under both theories.
I'm not certain whether you could recover the full gamut of damages under a contract cause of action or not. I have not analyzed the case from that standpoint, and I'm really not comfortable commenting on that. But I think clearly they should be entitled to under the tort cause of action. I did want to make a comment about the reasonable certainty requirement on the lost profits. The Court of Appeals did not consider this to be an established business. They said, well, the prior chicken business the Sloans were in was not the same. I think that this is an established business because of the fact that there are other growers under this program with Pilgrim's Pride, and there's considerable evidence about this in the record to show that it's an established ongoing business as to other people, and that it's appropriate and should be recognized that that type of evidence can satisfy the reasonable certainty requirements. It's analogous to a situation involving a fast food franchise or something of that nature. It gives the jury a reasonable basis for determining with reasonable certainty what the profits would have been, and the evidence is there to show how closely controlled this was. Actually, the growers just owned the houses. The poultry company owned the chickens, put the chickens in the houses, delivered the feed. They were out there a couple of times a week. They very carefully controlled everything, and they had it down to within 1 or 2 cents per head how much profit these people would make.
Could you say that in every case, though, where you're attempting to prove lost profits, that someone else has a track record, therefore that should be some evidence to support our claim of lost profits, even though we have none?
In a case such as this one, where it is as tightly controlled as that, you should be able to, I would submit. I think the requisite degree of certainty is there, and in fact, if it's not there in this case, nobody is ever going to be able to recover lost profits on a new business, no matter how meritorious their claim might have been otherwise.
Well, that's been the law for a long time, hasn't it? Southwest Battery case?
Well, that's certainly the truth, but that does not change the fact that it's time for a change in the law. We're denying people a rightful recovery on a basis that no longer meets the test of logic in a situation like this. I think the Allied Bank case, again, is some authority for the proposition that they should look not just to what these people did in their old chicken houses, but to what the other growers working with Pilgrim's Pride under this program did. The Tyler Court said that they did not even bother to consider Mr. Burke's testimony because it only attempts to establish what the plaintiff's profits would have been if they'd had the future contract, and I disagree with that statement. It showed both what his actual experience had been in an established business and also that the amount of the profits was subject to calculation with reasonable certainty. What's happened there, again, is that the court has lapsed into a contract analysis of a tort cause of action, and I think it's inappropriate. I'd like to move now and discuss briefly some of the issues that have been raised, particularly in the amicus brief, with regard to whether or not under Girard there is an independent tort for negligent infliction of emotional distress, and I think it's clear that there is. The Girard case says so in as many words. Freeman and Reagan certainly do not overrule Girard. This court in the Winters versus Texas Department of Corrections case denied a writ where the cause of action was purely based on negligent infliction of mental anguish, and Girard is alive and well, and we do have that cause of action in this state, and until the Supreme Court specifically overrules Girard, I think it's going to continue to be viable, and it's certainly available in this case. The Tyler Court correctly reasoned that mental anguish damages should be recoverable because they are in all tort cases where they're properly pled and proved, as they were here. The Tyler Court cites several different classes of traditional pecuniary loss cases where the courts of appeals have allowed recovery of mental anguish damages. To that list, we might also add the Stewart case that's cited in footnote 5 of the Girard opinion, which is, again, a case from the 1800s and shows that Texas jurisprudence has recognized that as a recoverable element of damages. I think the conclusion that mental anguish damages should be recoverable in this case is compelled by the series of decisions that have come out of this court with Sanchez and the progeny of that, removing the arbitrary restraints. I think that a refusal to recognize mental anguish damages in a case of this type would be to blindly ignore the fact that financial catastrophe ruins lives and wrecks dreams and inflicts misery and suffering every bit as much as personal injuries do. The Girard case says clearly freedom from severe emotional distress is an interest which the law should serve to protect, and this is a case in which it should do that. I'd like to again emphasize that this negligent misrepresentation cause of action is a common law cause of action, and as this court said in the El Chico case and reaffirmed in Reagan, the common law is not frozen and static, but it's evolving, and it's the duty of this court to recognize that evolution and extend it. And it's time for the Texas Supreme Court to recognize what the courts of appeals have for some time, and that is that negligent misrepresentation is a cause of action in tort in this state, and that the plaintiff should be entitled to recover all the damages that are proven to proximately result therefrom, including mental anguish damages. To do otherwise is going to create a preferred class of commercial tortfeasors who are not held accountable for the full consequences of their actions, and it would indeed be a giant step backwards in the jurisprudence of this court with regard to damages. We would request that the judgment of the trial court be in all things affirmed.
Any questions?
Thank you, Jim.
Briefly, Your Honors, I would like to respond first to the issue of tort damages versus contract damages and refer you to Section 552B of the Restatement of Torts concerning mental anguish, where it says the damages recoverable for negligent misrepresentation do not include the benefit of the plaintiff's contract with the defendant. So whether you look at it contractually or tortiously, the Tyler Court of Civil Appeals was correct in holding that lost profits could not be recovered even for this tort. As to the last statements as to mental anguish, I'd like to take you through at least what I understand from your decisions to show you the difference that I have with counsel as to the statement that all torts involving negligence can get mental anguish. Certainly the St. Elizabeth's opinion does not support that, because you said there, in fact, that Sanchez had involved a statutory tort and nothing else, and that was in footnote 1 at page 651. In a footnote to Sanchez, the court said that it was a statutory tort and that she did not meet the bystander requirement. Certainly an assertion that mental anguish is available to all negligence causes of action would run counter to that assertion. Similarly, in Freeman, mental anguish damages were denied to a stepfather whose son was killed. Again, it contradicts the argument that any negligence would support mental anguish. In Reagan, decided last December, a claim for negligent infliction of mental anguish that was not based upon the wrongful death statute, you held that the plaintiff had to be a bystander. So again, that is not a holding, and it does not support the assertion that mental anguish has been expanded to all negligence claims by this court. Instead, as I see your opinions, you are grappling with the concept of the familial relationship. There are certainly the dead body cases, the death messages cases. But you seem to me to be saying that inherent in all those relationships are mental anguish. And where I think the line can be drawn clearly and consistently is that it is not inherent in economic relationships that there will be mental anguish. And for that reason, I believe it would be bad policy to extend the cases as they stand. I think it would be a great leap in logic and a great leap in policy. And certainly, the Tyler Court cites the Texas Department of Corrections case, which is a death message case. And I just don't think you can get from there to the application of it in all negligence cases. Here, they didn't plead an intentional tort. They didn't plead a bystander. They didn't plead negligent infliction of mental distress. And I think we have to ask ourselves from a policy standpoint whether a disappointed borrower has inherent in that relationship that as a policy we should extend these cases to include them. And I suggest to you that subjecting banks to that kind of liability is either going to increase the cost of loans or more likely may make fewer loans. And we all know that one of the problems our economy has today is that banks aren't making enough loans. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the third cause and concludes the business of the court in this session for today. Foregoing cases are submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will now please adjourn the court. Yeah.